Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It is Tuesday, and once again, we're asking ourselves, are we really going to do this? Are we going to shut down the government? Will there be a default on the national debt since the Republicans have blocked raising the debt ceiling? Are Democrats really going to engage in mutually assured destruction? It's all packed into 1 week. And, you know, at the end, you sort of hope that saner, more rational heads prevail. But as I wrote in my newsletter this morning, it does look like you're watching multiple games of chicken. And everybody remembers chicken. It's not a game that I ever played. Chicken is kind of like Russian roulette with cars. You never did this, right, Bill?
I grew up in New York City. We didn't even know what cars were, really, just subways, you know. But yes, I'm aware of what playing chicken is, however.
Okay, so just to clarify this, you know, in the game of chicken, two people drive two very fast cars toward each other from the opposite ends of a long straight road. And the point is that, you know, one of them has to swerve away, and the person that swerves away is called the chicken.
Right.
But here's the catch. If neither of them swerve, they crash and everybody dies.
Right.
So this is the problem. So they both imagine that they're seeking this advantage, that they're being master negotiators by seeming inflexible. And of course, all of their supporters are egging them on in op-ed pieces and tweets, urging them not to blink. But if they get it wrong, it's a blazing inferno. And I'm sitting back watching, you know, watching the vote about the debt ceiling, watching the Democrats threaten to kill their own bill, hold their own bill hostage if they don't get everything they want. And you sort of hope it doesn't end in a blaze of failed presidency punditry. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, what's amazing, and you sort of hinted at this, but just to make it, put the dot the I on this and cross the T, the Democrats are playing a game of chicken among themselves. Right. I mean, it's one thing to play a game of chicken against the opposition party, and maybe that's a little more like the debt limit, you would say. But the actual infrastructure bill, the $1.2 trillion and then the $3.5 trillion reconciliation, that's an intra-Democratic fight. And you'd think maybe they would think, you know, can't get everything right away. Let's make sure President Biden has a reasonably successful first year here. Let's get the stuff that's doable. Let's highlight the incredible Republican irresponsibility on the debt ceiling, incidentally. And let's highlight, you know, what Biden's doing pretty well, I'd say, on the virus and all that. And instead, everyone is obsessed with this, as you say, this kind of posturing, but it could be more than posturing, among the Democrats, the intra-Democratic fights.
Well, I'm sorry to do this in multiple podcasts, but I do think we have to kind of do this again, especially since the progressives are saying that they have as many as 60 votes to vote against the bipartisan bill. This is the one that got, I think I said 69 votes yesterday. I think it was 67 votes. Hmm. So I want to correct that. So they would have 60 progressive Democrats who would vote against their own bill if their other plan isn't passed. And it's like, take a deep breath here. I mean, look, threatening to kill your own bill, a bill you favor that includes a lot of your party's agenda, that polls very well, that represents your president's premier legislative achievement. Now, maybe that's just a negotiating tactic. Fine. But actually voting against it is nuts. And I think I described it yesterday on television as a supreme political malpractice, particularly right now.
I can't believe they actually will, but I guess it's possible. I mean, you know, there aren't the votes for the $3.5 trillion in the Senate anyway, so that's going to have to be whittled down according to what Manchin and Sinema and some others actually are willing to support, and there's a lot of moving parts of that bill. And instead, we have progressives, you know, holding on to this magic number. They could have a good debate, incidentally. I think a pretty good debate for the Democrats on particular parts of this bill, because some parts of it are quite popular. I think other parts could be thrown out pretty easily. Child tax credit, for example.
Yeah. Big, yeah.
Instead, they've got it all lost in this $3.5 trillion number. And I say I'm sort of struck talking to, you know, swing voters, future former Republican types who voted for Biden. No one's looked at this bill closely to know what's in it, but they have the sense of, oh my God, here are the Democrats. They were supposed to come in and restore normalcy and govern responsibly. And they're just going with a typical, you know, big, super big government liberal wish list. And maybe that's a little unfair, but it certainly looks that way. And the more the progressives talk about it, the more I'd say swing Republicanish voters think, oh my God, the Democrats haven't learned any lessons.
No, I think that's right. And I said yesterday on the podcast with Amanda Carpenter that there were some things in this bill that I liked, and I was thinking about the child tax credit specifically. I think that's good policy. I think maybe some of the expansion of Medicare, I think is legitimate, modernizing it. But then you get to things like spending billions of dollars putting charging stations around the country for electric cars. Fine if you want to have an electric car, but I don't recall the government and taxpayers funding gas stations in the past. I mean, I just there are something, you know, this obsession with the fast trains. I don't want to get into the policy weeds on all of this, but I don't think they've broken it out. I don't think that they've made the case. And now we were in this kind of slightly silly debate about whether or not it costs a lot of money. And, you know, we get bogged down in the terminology. So the Democrats are now saying it won't cost anything, by which they really mean it won't add to the deficit, because obviously it's going to cost a lot of money and someone's going to have to pay for it. So I think it's a little bit self-destructive to say, to go for months and say, we have to spend this just, buttload of money, $3.5 trillion, and then suddenly pivot and go, but actually it's nothing. It's completely free. It's all free. Well, it's not free to everybody. If you're going to spend money, it's going to spend money. And people, see, that's the common sense thing. That's where I think the swing voters kind of roll their eyes and go, oh, come on. Okay, if you want to spend money, fine. Let's spend money on things that actually are good, that will make life better, that will solve problems. But don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining. You know what I'm saying?
Right. And I mean, some of this is a product of the kind of crazy budget rules and congressional rules we're now dealing with, where it all has to be jammed in one reconciliation bill. In a normal world, you could have a vote on the child tax credit. You could have a vote on the housing money. You could have a vote on the electric cars, and some of it would pass and some of it wouldn't. And of course, we don't live in a normal congressional world. So the system's dysfunctions are combining with huge amount of partisanship, combining with the fact that one party, the Republicans, really have no interest in governing. I mean, that's what's also striking. So the Republicans may end up benefiting just because people look at that and think, "Well, that's just too much." But what is the Republican counter proposal? I mean, which are they for? Are they for no tax increases on anyone? Are they for just status quo in every respect? Are they for none of the spending? I mean, it's unclear. I mean, the one thing they did, and this is again, one thing they got, what was it, 1917 Republicans to vote for, was the bipartisan infrastructure bill. I don't even have a strong view, honestly, how important that is as a matter of policy or for the country. But once you get that kind of victory in one body, it's a very big signifier that a president is doing well. I mean, that was so important for Reagan back in 81. He got Democratic votes, obviously, for his, in the House especially, for his tax bill. It gives you the kind of legitimacy that it's not just jamming through something in a partisan way. The idea that you wouldn't then carry that over into the House, put some pressure on some of the Republicans in the House to vote for it, and some are going to, apparently, just bracket the whole reconciliation thing for a while, keep the government open, pass the CR, and then hammer the Republicans, I would say, on their irresponsibility on the debt ceiling. They have a pretty, I think, honestly, the Democrats have a pretty good hand to play for the next month, but they're too busy, as you say, playing chicken with each other.
No, see, this is it. They step on their own message. And the decision by Mitch McConnell to filibuster the raising of the debt ceiling, I mean, this ought to be, this really ought to be hung around their necks, because this is so cynical. It is so reckless. I mean, it really is playing chicken with the nation's economy. And they ought to be held accountable for. And I have to say, I'm very disappointed that all the Republicans have gone along with a maneuver that's that cynical and reckless.
I'm a little shocked. I mean, they would say, well, this is all, jockeying. And of course, ultimately, we're going to do it. But we need to bring home how irresponsible the Democrats are being by wanting to spend so much. But the debt ceiling has nothing to do with what's going to be spent. Not much to do with what's going to be spent over the next 10 years. It has to do with the fact that we're already exceeding it because of what's been spent over the, or about to exceed it, because of what's been spent over the last few years. So most of which Republicans have been for. So it's totally irresponsible. I think the Democrats, they're terrified, apparently, of not terrified, but they're worried about passing the debt ceiling increase on a partisan vote. I think that could be a winning issue for them. I don't think voters care much about it. I just think if you explain to voters a little bit, this is imperils our economy, people would say, they're being responsible, kind of a Biden type thing to do. But they're not making that case. They're all lost in the infrastructure stuff. I would say the Biden administration also, and this, I don't know where this comes from exactly, but they've invested so much in the whole in infrastructure, and then in the big reconciliation version of it, human infrastructure, whatever they're calling that. And they've sort of lost, I don't know. I mean, that's fine. That's, they're Democrats. They want to do that. It's not the only thing that matters. You know, democracy matters and other issues matter. And the virus really matters. And they could really focus like a laser on that. And they've kind of, I think, lost the thread by being so, letting the news be so dominated by these intra-democratic nominations on this.
Yeah, I mean, two points there. You know, number one, they need to keep reminding people that raising the debt ceiling has nothing to do with future spending. It basically says we are going to pay the bills that we've already run up. So you have Republicans that ran up massive trillion-dollar deficits and now are refusing to raise the debt ceiling to pay for what we have already spent. So there is nothing conservative about refusing to pay your bills. That's number one. Number two, running the risk of shutting down the government in the midst of a pandemic, I mean, that's what is breathtakingly irresponsible. And a disciplined Democratic Party should really point out that, look, you know, if we put country over party, no political party would run the risk of doing that right now. We are in the midst of this crisis. It is a bipartisan crisis. They're not Democrats and they're not Republicans. There are people who are dying, who rely on the government right now. And yet the headlines are all about Nancy Pelosi versus the squad.
Yeah, I mean, why don't they say, look, do you want the FDA not to move as quickly as possible to approve vaccinations for 5 to 11-year-old kids? Wouldn't that be kind of a good thing? Do you really want to risk the government shutting down and the FDA being furloughed for a week or two or three? I mean, you'd think they could hammer the Republicans on this. This gets to one problem of the, about the Biden administration, I think, which is I can see why they don't want the president himself to be the carrier of the really partisan message, right? He should be a little bit above it. But who does carry that message? Pelosi's busy running the House, which is a you know awfully big job, and Schumer's busy running the Senate. There's no, I don't know, there's no senior Democrat who's just saying what we're saying, frankly, here every day and making putting pressure on Republicans politically. I feel like they're just getting a pretty clear, I mean, some of us say things, and obviously you know, various people in the media say things, but who are the political Democrats who make life difficult for Republicans when they're wildly irresponsible, either on the continuing risk, either on shutting the government down or the debt ceiling, or on you know democracy-related issues. And I don't think they're paying what the Republicans are not paying the price they should be paying on this because no one's really bringing it home, I would say.
Okay, so speaking of democracy, I think that's part of the irony of this particular moment that we are facing these multiple existential threats, the pandemic being one, but the threats to democracy, the possibility of a constitutional crisis. This is an odd moment to pick to play the game of political chicken. But let's segue here, because I wanted to ask you this question. You had done a series of tweets back before the inauguration, back in the former guys era, about how alarmed you were. And as it turned out, maybe none of us were sufficiently alarmed. But I guess here's the question I want to tee up here. How worried should we be now? And there's really a robust, interesting debate about all of this. You have Robert Kagan writing in the Washington Post that we are already in the midst of a constitutional crisis. We need to come to grips with it. You have others who are writing that, you know, maybe it's not so serious. Trump is too incompetent. These are signs of a lack of confidence. So where do you come down, Bill Kristol? How worried should we be? And I know there's been a lot of talk about the Robert Kagan essay, but I do think that that's one of the that's a great starting point because his argument is that we're headed toward a real constitutional crash in 2024, and we're in the midst of it right now. Do you agree?
Yes. I mean, I talked with Bob and I are old friends. We co-authored a million things on foreign policy back in the day. And so I talked to him a lot about that piece as he was working on it and, you know, working it through in his own mind about what to emphasize and what made the points most clearly. And I think it's an excellent piece, which everyone should read, long, but actually very important. And I guess, and then of course, there's been some sniping and it's fine. People can differ. Oh, he exaggerates this problem or the solution he mentions wouldn't work so well. So let's leave aside the solutions for a minute. But in terms of the problem and the challenge, I think honestly, a lot of the sniping is just silly. What if the odds are not 60% that we're in a constitutional crisis, but 20%? Yeah. Are we still not, is that not still terrifying? I mean, do we have is it non-trivial? Is there a non-trivial chance that we could have a Republican Party the Trump will be the nominee in 2024. That's probably a key part of the crisis. Not necessary. You can write scenarios where it's not Trump, but I think Trump is sort of key to this, and Bob makes that point. But what are the odds that Trump's the nominee, Republican nominee in 2024? 50-50, at least. What are the odds that that Biden might have messed up some things and it's a competitive election and there's a default of some Republicans back to Trump and it's pretty close and Trump then goes full in with the 2020 election overturning, but does it, more successfully with the ground having been laid with no Brad Raffensperger, et cetera, in 2024. I think the odds of that are not trivial. So we're talking about a real possibility. It may not be a 50% possibility, it may be a 25% possibility, but the idea that we can just slough that off and say it was kind of incompetent, it didn't work in 2020, I don't know, maybe some of these states will still have Democratic governors or not. There's just not a sense of urgency about this. And you see that in the failure to deal with the democracy promoting an election, anti-election overturning legislation in Congress. I think you see it at the state level where there's an awful lot of sort of complacency or apologetics about various bills, which right now, maybe they restrict voting a little bit, but they don't, of course, do anything in 2021, but they lay the predicate for doing things. And most important, that you have a whole party that has internalized the big lie and has internalized the most authoritarian and undemocratic responses based on the big lie to our current situation. I always come back, and you and I have discussed this before, to the Republican Party in this sense. If Trump were an ex-president and was screaming and yelling and having rallies and just kind of, denouncing everyone and saying the election was stolen, but he was not having much effect. Governors were governing and senators were being senators, and he was kind of out there by himself. You should be worried he's an ex-president, but it would be a very different thing. But Trump has shown over and over an ability to control the Republican Party, to shape it, including after January 6th, including as we speak in terms of primaries and stuff. And so he is the leader of one of our two major parties, which has, basically half the support of the country, it seems, 50 senators, 210 House members. And no one's really taking him on. One or two people are, Liz Cheney and Kinzinger. Mm-hmm. A few people have kind of quietly, have made clear they disapprove of him, but aren't really fighting the fight every day, the Mitt Romneys of the world, a couple of governors. But, and that's just to have a whole party that is on board, this kind of anti-democratic authoritarian agenda. I think that's pretty unprecedented in American history.
Well, you mentioned how the Republicans have internalized the big lie. And I think that the reaction, again, to the Arizona fraud, it is very, very revealing. In a normal world, this would have dampened the push for the Stop the Steal type audits around the country. But it hasn't even been a blip. It's not even a speed bump. I mean, if truth actually—
I think that's a very important point, Charlie. Right. That was, and the people who initially said, I think you and I didn't say this, but, well, that's going to put that to rest. Oh, good news for us. And I think you and I both sort of said, I don't know, this is just going to mean they won't believe the results. They've now legitimated, in a sense, the people who are relaxing are now going to say, well, I guess we can afford to have these audits elsewhere because they turned out not to actually change anything. And so then you're laying the predicate for partisan, non-professional, totally political, audits and re-audits in other states where maybe they're better organized and able to actually reverse vote totals. So I agree. It's very dangerous. The other thing I would say on the election, this is slightly different, but I'm curious what you think about this. I was thinking about this the other night. The vaccination stuff is really amazing.
Amazing.
How could a major political party become anti-vaccine? I mean, it's one thing to be, it had all kinds of elements. You've called them the recessive genes of the Republican Party. So if you had told me 5, 7, 8 years ago, well, the party's going to kind of indulge in a lot more nativism and some racially tinged, to say the least, rhetoric and some all kinds of things that we don't approve of. Obviously, even the election stuff, that's kind of, that's political power. How could you have a political party that's not just anti-mask, which is crazy itself, but in effect anti-vaccine, or certainly, anti doing your best to make sure that lives get saved through the vaccine? It's sort of amazing how much, where the polarization can lead to something that's so destructive of people's well-being, just in a very concrete sense. And it's sort of something that was not part of the right wing ecosphere before, right? It's not like, not you know, all. If you told me the party was going to be hostile to the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, we would have said, okay, well, maybe that's right. You know, unfortunate maybe, but correct. But what's the vaccine? So that just shows to me how deep the craziness goes, honestly.
Well, it does. And of course, you know, you remember how conservatives reacted when they thought there might be an outbreak of Ebola during the Obama years. I mean, even, you know, the Federalist, you know, Ben Domeck wrote a piece, you know, absolutely we ought to have mandates. Of course we should do that. And I think conservatives would have gone along with it in that circumstance. And if it's reversed, this is breathtaking, really. I mean, you know, and there's been the pattern over and over again, where you sort of see this small cloud off over on the horizon,
right,
and you think, okay, it's there, but it's not going to be a big storm. And then before you know it, you're caught up in the hurricane or these crazy ideas that are out there that suddenly become mainstream. And Trump himself has played a major role. You know, obviously Fox News has made a major role, but it still is stunning to see, you know, major conservative voices like Tucker Carlson, you know, highest rated host on Fox News, who's pushing, you know, raw racist memes like the Great Replacement Theory, anti-vax propaganda. I mean, kind of the worst of the worst now have the bully pulpit on the conservative movement. And even though it's been going on for so long, it is still stunning. But you're right about the vaccine. This is an issue that has nothing to do with real conservative values. I mean, conservatives always used to balance, you know, good order with liberty. And it is actually killing people. I mean, it's one thing to do things for ratings or for points or for, you know, to raise cash. But most people would have an instinctive recoil against doing something that will cost human lives in this particularly horrible way.
Yeah, and what strikes me with the vaccine is, and this is worrisome, I think, is that this was not particularly Trump's thing. He was terrible on masks. He exploited that. But the vaccine he took credit for, with some justice, I would say, incidentally. And he hasn't been a leader in the anti-vaccine stuff. He's, you know, at times sort of done a head nod to it and said, well, people should have freedom. But he took the vaccine. He's never really been out there hammering away on it, which makes me wonder how much this is now, we've almost escaped Trump, you know what I mean? The irresponsibility and the craziness is now out there and can be lit in any of a million places on social media and on Fox News or by some governor or by members of Congress. And they can, you know, they can throw the match in the gasoline pools. And it's not even anymore that Trump personally is kind of doing it, which is he is and which is terrible. But it sort of can, you know, spontaneously combust from various places around the country. And that then gets very dangerous, I think.
This is an important point, because it's important to understand that Donald Trump is a follower, really not a leader, that he keeps his sort of finger in the air to see where things are going, what are the themes going out there, and then he will adopt them. But he will not allow any gap to form between himself and that base, that feral base. So, yes, I think it has gotten away from him. I think that at this point, if he were to stand up and say, absolutely, you must get vaccinated, I'm going to, you know, get my booster shot on live television, that there would be this huge backlash. And of course, you saw that at one of his rallies where he immediately backed off on all of this. So, yeah, I do think it's out of control. All right, on this theme, though, of being alarmed. So we had the Arizona fraud, which made no difference whatsoever, because, look, if truth actually mattered, we wouldn't be where we are right now. It's been only about a week since we got the John Eastman memo. The Federalist Society lawyer who laid out in great detail how Mike Pence and the Trumpists in Congress would overthrow the election. And it is extraordinary that they put this thing in writing. And Robert Costa, who co-wrote the book with Bob Woodward, had an interesting tweet yesterday about the Eastman memo. He said, one key thing about that memo that's being lost, that it was not just a memo, some sort of paper passed around. It was a document and a plan that sparked a January 4th meeting with Trump, Eastman, and Pence and aides in the Oval Office, then the final January 5th Oval meeting. So again, this is not just a one-off. This was central to the sitting president of the United States scheme to overthrow the election, which of course is central to understanding what happened on January 6th. And we saw that a week ago, and it's sort of like, yeah, okay, we kind of knew that. It's okay, move on. What can we talk about now? No.
Yeah, now it is. I mean, and of course, one thinks sometimes, well, you can't relitigate everything from 8 months ago, so maybe it's best to just sort of focus on the current situation and all that. But I think that's not right. I mean, you do need to have this is where the January 6th commission is important, and, you know, these books are actually important. But how do you get voters and citizens to sort of really come to grips with what almost happened? It is a problem when you dodge a bullet, you know, you sort of, it's very scary at the time. And then 3 months later, you sort of half forget how close it came. And somehow bringing that home to people. And again, but it's one thing, again, if that all this cast of characters is gone, but Trump is there. Trump is promoting the same people that he was promoting on January 4th and 5th, right? And Marjorie Taylor Greene and all these other people. Not just them, though. I mean, I feel like these open seat races in the Senate, the Republican primaries, are terribly revealing. You know, maybe they'll go in a different way. Maybe J.D. Vance and Josh Mandel have overplayed their hands. And of course, it's so ludicrous when you see what they're saying that you just tend to make fun of them. But what would it say if in major states like Pennsylvania, where Craig Snyder, whom I know a little bit, pulled out yesterday, the one non-Trump Republican.
Oh, he did.
Yes, okay, yes.
I missed that. I'm sorry.
I haven't talked to him.
That is not encouraging.
But I think mostly he just didn't have much support. And in Ohio, and again, that these people that now maybe again maybe it'll there'll be a backlash against them either in the primaries or in the general election. But it's not as if Mitch McConnell, and that was a very revealing piece last week, I think, that didn't get enough attention. Mitch McConnell is fine with all of them. He says this on the record. You know what? We need 51 senators. Herschel Walker. And in effect, he's saying the Ohio guys, Mandel and Vance and the Pennsylvania people and all these people, if they're the nominee, we're all with them. So you don't even get the McConnells of the world. I don't even know if you get the Mitt Romneys of the world, honestly, saying, well, I couldn't support that person. This is where I think Liz Cheney has gone. And Adam Kinzinger, but almost no one else in the party. If we cannot support certain people because they are fundamentally a threat to democracy. And until people in the party are willing to say that, even the better people, the people who don't believe it, the people who are personally decent, the people who aren't fanning the flames, they're still going along.
Well, it wasn't that long ago that when a candidate, even a nominee for the Senate said something that was considered to be beyond the pale, the Republicans around the country felt free to distance themselves from them, right? I mean, you know, we think of the Todd Akin case. There's a series of others that I probably memory hold. But other Republicans understood that they did not want to be associated with somebody who was beyond the pale. And that no longer exists. It has become lockstep. It's even and as you suggest, it's even become accepted among people who you'd expect more from.
I mean, you're there in Wisconsin. Do you think how many Republican, office holders at the state level, the local level, how many Republican activists would look at Ron Johnson, who's been mind-bogglingly irresponsible on the vaccine in the last several months, as you've documented many times, and say, I just can't support him? I don't know. Not many, I suspect, right?
No, but I think among the donor class, I think that there's some pushback. And again, I don't know whether he's running for re-election again. Okay, so I want to read some stuff to you and get your reaction on this debate about how worried should we be. We talked about the Kagan piece, which I thought was very, very powerful. If people haven't read it, they need to go and look at it. Over at Politico, Jack Schaefer writes a dissent. He writes that the fears may be overblown because these are signs of political weakness. And I'll read one paragraph. Trump and his Republicans fear their own disintegration. That sense of threat gives them power over the voter base, but it has also made them politically desperate. Their lack of scruples doesn't make them omnipotent. It makes them vulnerable to serious and determined opponents. The wildness of Trump's last-ditch maneuver, whatever it turns out to be, will require much from us, but above all, it will oblige us to keep our cool and just vote. You don't beat a crazy card player by going crazier. So his argument is not that it's not bad, but that this is a sign of disintegration rather than a sign that they're about to sweep away constitutional norms.
Both could be true. They could be desperate. They could be vulnerable. And that could make them more dangerous. We see that in foreign policy often, where people launch wars because not because they're strong, but because they're worried they're getting weaker And that's kind of a conventional view of a lot of big conflicts and a classic dangerous situation. And in that respect, the fact that Trump doesn't have a super solid grip on everything and that they could lose and therefore they're worried, is that reassuring? And again, I mean, the card metaphor is bad because, of course, the point is they're going to cheat. They're going to kick over the card table. It's not like you just play your cards and you put down your three tens and they only have two pair and then they're going to say, oh, okay, you take the pot. That's not what we're looking at. We're going to have suddenly discover that two pair beats three tens, three of a kind.
Yeah. So,
the final point I'd make is the one I made before. Okay, maybe the chances of all this going awry are 30%, not 60%. Is that fine? Is that reassuring? We can just vote. I mean, I'm all for voting, and I think it's very important that people get out there and vote for democracy. But, how the rules of the game are shaped and how much polluting there is of the public mind by the disinformation, that matters too.
Yeah. Okay. So Daniel Dresner makes, I think, a similar point to the one you just made. He writes in the Washington Post, how scared should we be about 2024? And he writes, if anything, and he's answering Schaefer's argument that I just gave you. If anything, however, the waning of Trump's electoral fortunes makes Kagan's warning more and not less salient. As Schaefer acknowledges, the less likely Trump is to win legitimately, the more he and his supporters will use any means necessary to try to get their way. Endgame strategies include a lot of risky Hail Mary gambits that look about as coherent and extra legal as a John Eastman memo. Or to use the argo the Trumpists like, they will act as though they have already lost control of Flight 93 and storm the cockpit, even though they are the terrorists. So his point is, okay, so they may be losing, but desperate people can do a lot of damage. And I think that's the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an important point that Dresner makes. And I would also again say, are we that confident they're losing? I mean, he lost a few million votes from 2016 to 2020, having utterly misgoverned during a pandemic and having done everything else he did. The Republicans picked up, 12 House seats? It's 50-50 in the Senate. It's not so, I don't know quite where everyone's got. They look at a couple of polls and Trump's approval is a little lower than Biden's. And they're sort of confident that can't come back together. I think Trump isn't probably the strongest Republican candidate in 2024. There's got to be some number of swing voters who just can't quite stomach him coming back. Having said that, once he's the nominee, and this is something you've thought about a lot, knowing a lot of Republicans and the next Republicans, a lot of the donors, a lot of the elected officials, maybe almost all of them, will talk themselves into a kind of rationalization of, well, you got to support the Republicans, and I don't think he's as weak as people are saying.
Oh, I completely agree with you, and especially this is another reason why I have been railing about the incompetent politics of Democrats. One of the reasons we've been rooting for the success of the Biden presidency is not because we support all of the policies, because we don't. It's because we know that the price of failure is catastrophic. Okay, one more quote here. So Damon Linker writes about this in The Week, and he is pushing back against the argument, nothing to worry about because Trump's too incompetent to pull off a coup. And so he has a piece called The Unimportance of Trump's Incompetence. It wouldn't take any kind of governing competence at all for Trump to sow chaos after the 2024 vote, which is really all that Kagan predicts, including weeks of competing mass protests across multiple states as lawmakers from both parties claim victory and charge the other with unconstitutional efforts to take power. Where would such chaos end? I have no idea, but it's nowhere good. And Donald Trump has more than enough talent to pull it off. Now, I agree with that. It doesn't take a lot of competence to see, to take that match and throw it on the kerosene.
Right. And again, who knows what happens in the next 2-3 years? Maybe there's a recession. Maybe China does something in Taiwan and we end up in a military conflict. It's quite possible that voters judge, I hope it's not the case, but the Biden administration to be a failure, at least in some respects, by 2024, want to remove it and put in the other party. Who knows, maybe there'd be an intra-democratic fight too. But, and so again, I mean, what if Trump, here's another thought experiment. What if Trump wins the election in 24? I mean, actually wins it, not through cheating. Now, we wouldn't, I think, seek to overturn that. He would have won, and that's democracy. But what would he do in a second term? Right? You come back to the 2020 reasons we were all so hard, so committed to being against him in 2020. Another term of Trump, given his what we see, how he thinks about the rule of law and the Constitution and use of the military and the Justice Department and stuff, that's also very scary. So the whole, you know, again, you can write different scenarios, but there's a non-trivial chance that we are in a real crisis. I guess I'd put it that way. We don't know. These things are very contingent on events. We don't know how these crises play out. But I think that you've used this metaphor before, and I think it remains a good one. You got huge pools of gasoline sitting around, people tossing matches. Maybe we'll kind of get lucky and we'll hurry over and put out this fire and that one, and some of the gasoline will go away and people will calm down and some of the match throwers will retreat. And Trump himself won't be the, you know, quite as significant as the chief match thrower, but maybe not.
So I've been toying around with this idea, and so this is a preliminary thought. You know, you and I have both said it is absolutely crucial in American politics that we have two rational political parties, that you have two parties that are committed to democracy. And a slightly different gloss on all this. Maybe it occurred to me when I was reading a story about how New York Democrats are aggressively pushing the gerrymander because they figure, look, Republicans are going to be gerrymandering, so we need to counter that by drawing, really partisan lines to maximize our support. Which, by the way, is, you may say it's hypocritical, but it's also rational behavior that if one party decides to violate the rules, it seems naive to think that the other party won't adopt the same tactic. So, for example, if you're watching a football game and one team just simply decides to, ignore every rule, commit every kind of penalty, and then you realize that the refs are not enforcing it, and maybe that the refs are, egging on, the game is not going to be the same. You're not going to have one team that's going to play by the traditional rules. They will adapt as well. So I wonder, as these norms get attacked, are Democrats that confident that they are the party of democracy? If, in fact, it looks like Trump has used his power to overturn the election in some states that Biden might have won, are we absolutely sure the Democratic legislators might not try to do the same thing? And I guess what I'm getting at is that this becomes a spiraling issue where as the Republicans abandon any sense of fair play, the Democrats go, well, why should we be the suckers here? Why shouldn't we adopt the same sort of tactics? And we know how this plays out. And at that point, then the Democratic norms have no bulwark at all.
Yeah, no, I think that's well said, and good use of the term bulwark. That was nice. I think one part of Bob Kagan's piece that hasn't gotten as much attention is, and he's pretty brief when he discusses possible remedies to the situation, partial remedies. But one thing he says is Romney and others should think about forming a kind of constitutional Republican caucus in the Senate. Presumably the same would be in the House. Maybe it's only 5-7 members, but they withhold their votes on certain things. They support Democrats on other things. They negotiate. They find Democrats with whom they can talk about some of these issues. You know, there are some reasonable, and the Biden administration. I think that's very, the more I've thought about it, I think that's important for the country. I mean, because otherwise you are kind of, you do risk the spiral that you're talking about. And even if there are 100 senators and this is only 5 of them, it could be important, obviously, in on the margin. And they hold up something as a kind of banner, which is actually the rule of law and respect for the Constitution. So I don't quite know how one operationalizes that. But right. I think that's an important suggestion of Bob's.
So I guess this leads to the question, and I get this all the time, well, what can we do about it? What is the appropriate response to all of that? And I don't always have a good, answer to that, except to, continue to speak out, push back against it, not go along with the crazy. But I don't know, what do you think, Bill? When people ask you, what do you do? Because I do think it's fair to say that there is no Republican civil war any longer. I mean, it's over. It's been done. Or am I wrong?
No. Well, you're probably right. I mean, though I would say that even Republican dissenters can make a big difference, even if there's not an ability to kind of fight an evenly matched civil war. So I'd say that's one thing we have to do. I just think more people should be like Liz Cheney. And fewer people, and I respect Mitt Romney, but I think the kind of silence of the Ben Sasses and Mitt Romneys at this point, or Anthony Gonzalez, whom I like and respect, and I was so sorry when he said he wasn't going to run for re-election, but now he's kind of just, I'm going to do everything I can to defeat Trump. And now he's gone totally solid. Now, again, it's only 2 weeks. So maybe he'll speak up. But I think Cheney, the 60 Minutes interview, the willingness to be on the January 6th commission, the willingness to say this is just unacceptable. I can't support Trump. I can't support McCarthy and Stefanik if they support Trump. She's gone further. And I think that's very important to hold that flag up, even if it, you know, is only a few members of the House. It could be, they could be decisive on the margin, obviously, in terms of governance of the House. And B, it does remind people, both Republicans and Democrats, that there's an alternate way. The other thing we can do, I think we think that we're have some good ideas on public policy that are pro-market, pro, you know, strong foreign policy. All those views we've had are not discredited. And we can help push the Biden administration to be more successful. I think that's actually pretty important. That is, to the degree, as I think, that they don't have the rapid testing because they're too deferential to the FDA bureaucracy, and it's not worth getting into all this in great detail, but some of us have made this argument, you know, this is a case where we should say, hey, Biden administration, we want you to succeed, but you can't just sort of go along, drifting along in some of these areas. And obviously that would be true of the Democratic Civil War too on the infrastructure bill. So I think we have, and again, I think we are right, the more generally pro-market the administration is in economics, fine, they'll spend more than we would like. But the more they don't really overregulate the economy, the more they let things go and have a good recovery, that's better for the country and ultimately better for the Biden administration.
And they don't have to be held hostage by the progressive wing. And there are many voices within the Democratic Party making the point that, look, the median voter is a white 50-year-old male. The fate of Congress will be decided by the fate of those moderates in swing districts. It won't be decided by the plus 40 Democratic districts or the plus 40 Republican district. So if moderates are concerned about something, I think it's worthwhile paying attention to them. And I think that the heart of the Democratic Party is not necessarily with the squad. And I think we've seen that in a number of these primaries. So I wish the administration had a little bit more willingness to stand up against those. Okay, one last comment, because I know we're running out of time. There's a piece in The Bulwark today by Shea Kateri that is really excellent about what went wrong with conservatism. I know you've read it, Bill. Yeah. You know, I have thought about this and read about this and written about this over and over again. And this is a substantive and painful analysis, because it focuses on what he calls the popularizers, people who popularize conservative ideas. And of course, for many years, I thought I was part of that on talk radio and writing things. And he writes, these popularizers did their jobs. Conservatism went from the pages of National Review to a governing majority in about two generations. But along the way, conservatism was dumbed down considerably. And then he describes how it happened. I really believe that we could popularize those ideas without dumbing it down, but in retrospect, that didn't happen. And I think you're seeing that. And one of the just marks of our time, and I suppose this is elitist in a way, is how dumb the arguments have become. I mean, I remember, and I was attracted to the right by the fact that it was so eloquent. I thought it was intelligent. I thought it was provocative. And now you look at it and it's like, bumper sticker Mad Libs of just random phrases, and the stupidity is painful.
Yeah, well, you've written very well on this. But I mean, I think the combination of, I was thinking about Shea's piece, I mean, of populism, which is sort of what he focuses on, and popularization. But then you combine that with a really heightened degree of partisanship, kind of toxic almost, partisanship, and I think all of us fell into this a little bit probably in the last 10, 20 years. And then the really crazy thing of the last 5, 6 years, which is the polarization. I mean, the kind of not just partisanship, I prefer, Republicans right, Democrats wrong, but kind of two different realities almost. Again, the vaccine strikes me as sort of the most perfect instance of this. You put all that together and it's hard to know. It wasn't inevitable, I don't think. And of course, there's always going to be popularization. There's always going to be partisanship. Any of these things can exist and it's not the end of the world, but somehow it did come together. And then Trump, and you put all that together and you do get something pretty toxic, pretty dangerous, pretty threatening to our democracy.
Yeah, well, it's definitely worth your time. Bill Kristol, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. We appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, Charlie.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.